When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, everybody. Hello, how you doing? I'm Brad Listy, and this is the Other People Show. I'm in Los Angeles. It's good to be with you. I have on the program today Matthew Spector. He is back for a second time. It's been a number of years since I talked with him, and I'm pleased to have him back as a guest as he celebrates the publication of a new book called Always Crashing in the Same Car, on art, crisis, and Los Angeles, California. It is available from Tin House, and it is superb. It's a book that defies easy categorization. It's an essay collection, it's a memoir, it's a work of cultural history. There might even be a little bit of cultural criticism sprinkled in there. And it's great, you know, it's greater than the sum of its parts. I loved this book. I looked forward to it every day. I didn't want it to end. I got sad when it ended. And I'm pleased to share the news of it with you and to have the chance to share this conversation with Matthew Spector. That is coming up momentarily. Today's episode is made possible by Custom House Books, publisher of the new novel Appleseed by Matt Bell. Kelly Link calls Appleseed, quote, as urgent as it is audacious. And Karen Russell calls it, quote, a work of incandescent imagination. Matt Bell is a Young Lions Fiction Award finalist. This is his breakout book. It explores climate change, manifest destiny, humanity's unchecked exploitation of natural resources, and the small but powerful magic contained within every single apple. The novel is set in 18th century Ohio, in 2020's United States, and 1,000 years into the future. It's got a lot going on, and Matt Bell seamlessly weaves these three narratives together using mythology, folklore, and science fiction. He has written an unforgettable speculative epic novel, Appleseed by Matt Bell, available now from Custom House Books. So my guest once again is Matthew Spector. His new book, available now from Tin House, is called Always Crashing in the Same Car, on art, crisis, and Los Angeles, California. Matthew Spector is a founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. He is also the author of several other books, including the novels American Dream Machine and That Summertime Sound, a nonfiction book called The Sting. And he's at work on another nonfiction book. You're going to hear us talk about that in the conversation. Again, the latest is called Always Crashing in the Same Car, available now from Tin House. Very pleased to have the opportunity to share this conversation with you now. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. This is Matthew Spector.
You know, when I was a teenager in LA in the 70s and 80s especially, there was so much feedback. You know, so much of the kind of image of Los Angeles was still being drawn by East Coast perceptions of Los Angeles, you know, and whether it was like Woody Allen films or you know, publishing, or, you know, you would get this kind of sense that like, oh, LA, it's that cultural desert, you know, nobody reads in Los Angeles. You know, so it felt particularly hostile to me. Like I really did kind of believe like, oh, I have to go elsewhere. And there was a kind of comical interlude that's not mentioned in the book, which is when I first went away to college, my roommate and then several of my friends were all from Columbus, Ohio. And I got very wrapped up with this group of people that were all from Columbus, and I sort of fell in love with Columbus, and kind of by extension with the Midwest. You know, I was sort of like, oh wow, you know, I found myself in Columbus, Ohio, and I was like, this is the coolest place I've ever been. which I think was quite wonderful too, because it kind of shattered my sense of America as a sort of place that exists as, you know, a pair of coasts and then something nebulous in between. You know, I went to Chicago, I went to Detroit, I went to a lot of places where I kind of discovered other aspects of experience that aren't just the ones from the coasts. But yeah, you know, I moved to New York, and then I moved to Massachusetts for school, and then to San Francisco, and then to New York, and then to London for a little bit, and then back to New York. And I came back to LA when I was, when my daughter had just been born. So I was 35, you know, I had gone from being a teenager to being an actual adult. And, and not only had my sense of LA softened and my sense of attachment to it kind of altered, because by the time you're that age, you kind of realize that you are only ever from one place, that your kind of your history and your kind of nascent experience. I mean, if you grew up in one place, you are from one place. And there was sort of forgiveness of my parents involved and all kinds of things, but also LA had changed. You know, I think LA in the year, 2000 was a completely different place than LA in 1982. I think that it had developed a lot more of its kind of cultural vernacular. And obviously there's always been, you know, besides the movies, there's been visual art. There is a kind of deep and rather profound literary history to Los Angeles that stretches beyond Nathaniel West and Joan Didion, obviously. And, it was a sort of a matter of both, you know, coming back as an actual adult without a kind of teenager's spiky, judgy, self-protective armor, and finding that Los Angeles had changed quite a bit
for the better.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. For the better. Although I'm not convinced that it hasn't changed for the worse again since, but yes, for the better.
Yeah. I guess first of all, why for the better from between, like, you know, the 1982 version when you're a teenager and you're in your kind of like your judgiest mode of life or whatever, and then coming back as a 35-year-old, what had changed that made it feel better to you?
I think some of its hegemonies had crumbled. I'm thinking about basically the sort of, you know, the inherited view of Los Angeles as a sort of cradle of spiritual emptiness had sort of been challenged by more people who'd come here, more artists, more writers, more people who had arrived, and probably a sort of widening lens of what the city's history really consisted of. So that I could, you know, in other words, not just a sort of changing of the guard and a sort of, I mean, again, I think the kind of boomers who had defined LA in the 80s were still very much in, you know, ascendant when I returned, but not alone. And I think some of our understandings too of LA's cultural history that had always been here were beginning to widen. And by which I mean stuff that isn't just about Hollywood or the movies, but I mean, you know, understanding about, I don't know, the Watts poets and a lot of the other cultural histories that had been, you know, written off to the margins was beginning to, you know, to expand itself somehow.
I find myself having a very complicated relationship with this city. I never fully feel like I belong here. I've said this many times. It's like a recurring theme in my life. I don't know if I fit. I don't know if the city wants me. I don't know if you've ever had that. I guess you kind of have had that feeling. You write pretty well about it. You know,
sure. Absolutely. And I think, you know, look, I think there's no, I mean, just because I love it doesn't mean that I'm free of ambivalence about it, or doesn't mean that I don't, you know, look at aspects of it with horror, or, you know, open my eyes somehow and look around and just think like, oh my God, like these people are assholes and I live smack dab in the middle of them. But I think one can have that experience in any city. and you know, the kind of, I mean, I don't know how much I fit in with the city's dominant culture. You know, I was sitting idling in my car the other day, and this blue Lamborghini kind of came roaring by me, and the kid behind the wheel, I mean, it looked like someone who was about 12, and the license plate was Bae, B-A-E. I did a little Googling, and I have a weird suspicion that it was actually Logan Paul. I'm not sure about that, but you know, I just, you know, there's that element of the city, that the sort of hype house element, the influencer element, you know, all of that stuff that's very prominent. And I certainly don't feel like I belong to that entirely. No offense. That's just a kind of co-function of aging, probably. But it's also, you know, it's a reminder that, you know, LA is really vast. There are many, many, many parts of it to which I don't belong, and that's true for any city, right? So even though I know LA has such a weird, it's like the kind of myth, the vibe of LA is meant to be so inviting and at the same time so exclusive, that I just think those feelings, that ambivalent, that sense of like, do I belong here, is, you know, would have to be somewhat universal for most of us kind of making our way through it with any degree of sentience at all.
Yeah, I sometimes find myself, you talk about modern influencer culture, talk about aging, which, you know, everyone's doing, but you and I are relatively close in age. Like, I find myself feeling like, especially over the past 10 to 15 years, like so much of the shine has come off the diamond when it comes to the entertainment business.
Yes.
And the reason I say that, I think, is because, well, a lot of the gates have come down in terms of, you know, who wants to make a movie. You can make a movie with your phone now and distribute it yourself. And if it's good enough, it'll find a big audience on the internet. It seems like you can become a billionaire, you know, by filming your kid opening presents on YouTube. I think the point that I'm driving at is that like kind of everybody, especially if you're on social media, is famous to some degree.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Yes. Yes. I think about this a lot.
Yeah. And yeah. So the mystique is gone. And I feel like too, like, I don't know. I sometimes contradict myself. Like, I'll sit around bitching about how the only thing that ever gets made and hyped in our film culture these days is, you know, comic book movies. This is so untrue. And it's such an inaccurate thing to say. I don't know why I keep saying it. It can feel that way. But the truth is that I think the more accurate truth is that there's so much content being made that I feel like the exclusivity is gone. It's too much to keep track of. It just feels like this giant tidal wave that just keeps rolling in of stuff that I'm never going to be able to watch. I don't even know what I'm missing half the time. And I think the question I would pose to you, because I think what I'm stating is relatively easy to agree upon, just the basic, like rough outline. Yes. But the question is, am I just a middle-aged guy who is getting cranky right on time and feeling like he's lost touch with the changing culture? Or are these things, are these developments really kind of to be mourned, you know, for people who have a love of film culture and cinema?
Yes. I mean, I think the answer to that has to be both. I mean, I'm certainly cognizant of the fact that, you know, this is what cultures do, all cultures, right? Literary culture, book culture, film culture, music culture, right? It's like cultures age and they sort of take their place in history, and you know, one never wants to be the sort of old guy who's like, oh, you know, things were better in my day. You know, even if they were, or they were at least for you, and that still counts, right? I don't mean for you, Brad. I mean, you know, for all of us who experience that, and I'm pretty sure that we all do, or we all will, at some point or another, you know. But I also think, you know, that question of sort of saturation, market saturation, you know, there's only so much we can pay attention to. You know, I mean, I think about that a lot because, you know, this book is another piece of cultural arcana entering the sphere, and how, you know, how important it is that people continue to make these things. You know, I don't mean how important my own book is, but how important it is that we continue to make art, and how important it is that we recognize the kind of the specificity of it. I think in a way it's like, you know, there's so much material out there, so many movies, so many TV shows, so many books, so many novels, so many memoirs, and the kind of countervailing force in the culture that is constantly trying to get us, you know, that is constantly trying to convince us that, like, these are the important ones, right? In a certain, you know, in other words, like, these are the movies you need to see. These are the shows you need to watch. This is the thing that's mandatory, that's relevant. You know, or, you know, as you just mentioned, Marvel movies, you know, these are the kind of things that are supposed to dominate the landscape, that are the thing, you know, these are the things that people are discussing. And I reject that. I reject the kind of hegemonic model. I reject the notion of you know, well, this is the thing that's urgent and relevant, because of course the question is always to whom. And you know, and also the fact that I think that works of art are you know, they're like messages in a bottle, you know, on some kind of root level. You write a book, you are casting it out, or you make a movie, or you make a record, or, you know, whatever piece of art that you make, a painting, and you're kind of casting it out into the world. And, you know, there's the kind of commercial imperative and commercial fate of it. But there's also the fate of it, you know, the encounter between, you know, individual person, between individual writer or viewer or reader, or rather individual reader or listener or viewer, and individual artist. And I think that contact, that one-to-one contact, is what matters. It might be all that matters in this way.
Yeah, and I think it can be easy in a place like Los Angeles that is so steeped in like mystical, what's the word I'm looking for with regard to fame culture? You know, there's this mythic, you know, this mythic quality to Los Angeles and what it means to succeed here. And yes. I feel like, you know, to speak more about the current cultural moment that we're in, where everybody's sort of famous.
Yeah.
Like some of that has been diminished. And I think even like true celebrities are feeling it. I don't know how they couldn't, you know, just this feeling of like, oh, I'm doing a Zoom interview on Conan, or, you know, like,
yeah,
it's just gotten cheaper or something, and yes, maybe not in an entirely bad way, because the, you know, some of the veil has been pulled away, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, I guess
I don't think it's a bad thing at all, really. Not really. I mean, you know, it's like, again, this is really in large part what the book is about, or at least in part, you know, the whole concept of celebrity or of, you know, becoming big, of you know, of blowing up, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, feels incredibly naff, as my English friends say to me these days. It just seems kind of lame, and like maybe the kind of, you know, the, like it'll, and by the same token, and I think this is also kind of literally true, there's a way in which privacy is now a kind of luxury good. It's like, you know, I almost sometimes feel like privacy or a certain level of obscurity is what an artist should almost strive for.
that's the ideal, isn't it? Yeah. Especially for a writer, is that your book goes out, it gets reviewed really well, a lot of people buy it and read it, and yet you go completely unrecognized in your day-to-day life, and nobody knows who you are except for your friends and family. I mean, that's kind of how you want it, right?
That's kind of the ideal. I mean, I think the idea, and, you know, I don't even know what would constitute being a kind of quote famous writer unquote anymore. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, famous in a kind of wider sense, you know, maybe Colson Whitehead or something. Colson Whitehead for sure, you know, or somebody like that. But even that seems like, you know, like, I don't know if that's an enviable position, particularly. Someone in publishing described that position to me recently as something, they said something like, you know, Hollywood problems, but not Hollywood money, or something like that. And I thought, yikes.
Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
So, okay. So you write really beautifully about Los Angeles in this book in a way that satisfied something in me. I've been like wanting to write. I think living here, you naturally find yourself thinking about writing about the place. But as a reader too, you know, especially in a contemporary context, I haven't read a book that gets this place this well. And I think, you know, to be fair, it's your experience. You have a particular background in this city and in your work life that meshes at least to some degree with the core cultural concerns of the place. Not only are you a writer and a screenwriter and a creative person, but you come from a family background where your father, Fred, is one of the founders of CAA. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, not quite one of the founders. The five founders formed it in 75 or 76. And he came over. He was sort of one of the handful of people that came over to join them a year or two later. So, you know, he wasn't like a founding founder, but he was like a kind of very early architect. I mean, I think he was there when there were fewer than 14 people working at the company. So it was still very small.
So one of the earliest hires and kind of a legendary talent agent in this town.
Yeah. I mean, I think at this point, kind of the last man standing of that generation, it's kind of insane that he's still active. And you know, I've seen him referred to in various print places as legendary. So I guess that's the word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's represented a lot of great actors. Like he represents De Niro, Morgan Freeman. Like you would know it better than I, but certainly
sure.
Some heavyweights.
Gene Hackman, Duvall. I mean, it's over the years he has represented, a lot of heavy people, Barbara Streisand, you go back, you know, even in the very beginning of his career, he represented, I mean, this was before he could even get him a job, but you know, Jack Nicholson, like a lot of people. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and I think like the point that I'm driving at is that you have that part of your family experience. You also have, a troubled relationship with your late mother, which you go into detail about in the book. And which I think is really the heart of the book is the relationship with your mom, who herself was a screenwriter, who I think was disappointed creatively, would be a way to put it.
Like and, most screenwriters, yeah, but maybe even more than most.
Yeah, and so I guess when I talk about like I think you're particularly well suited to write about this place, because you sort of have seen the gamut, you know firsthand what it's like to, you know, to be a disappointed screenwriter or to have borne witness to a parent who is struggling creatively. But you also have a parent who, by I think Hollywood standards, succeeded wildly and was sort of at the cool table, I guess is the way that I would put it. You know, like had access to all the things that I think people imagine having access to when they imagine Los Angeles, and you were kind of caught in the middle of it. You didn't ask to be born into, no one's asked to be born into the circumstances that they're born into, but you grew up amid all of this and then, you know, have had to try to forge your way as a writer, which really didn't materialize for you until later in your life. You know, you're not like F. Scott Fitzgerald publishing at 22.
I was doing it early. I mean, I was doing it when I was a teenager and onward, but I didn't succeed at it for a long time. And I think for, you know, a weird, slightly flukish, array of reasons, slightly flukish. And some of it just had to do with the kind of slower development of the ability and slow education and kind of, you know, rendering that into forms that might've been publishable. But, you know, I think that's the strangest thing about all of it is that, you know, I've never identified as anything other than a writer. I think, like a lot of writers, it was like the impulse and the education. It's like everything aimed itself that way for me from a very young age. And you know, for the longest time, I thought I'm never going to write about Hollywood. Like that's the most, you know, that's the most anti-literary place in the world. And you know, eventually, it became clear to me that you know that when you are a writer, you are dealt one hand, the hand of your own experience. And it's a strange and, you know, frankly, quite fertile experience that I've been dealt. You know, it's like, you know, if I were, I'm not comparing myself to these people, but it's like, you know, Faulkner you know, was given Mississippi to write about. You know, Toni Morrison had Ohio, Philip Roth had Newark, Saul Bellow had Chicago. You know, so L.A. and this particular strand of L.A., which is certainly, you know, only a strand of it, just happens to be the one that you know, that was given to me to work out.
Yeah. Well, and kudos to you. You did a great job. And I want to talk to you about success and failure, because these things too are at the heart of the book, and they really speak to me as somebody who is middle-aged, not like a roaring success. I don't know how many, I don't even know that many people who are. Maybe you know, on one hand, I can count the people I know who would actually qualify for that title in the traditional sense. But
I do, and you've had some of them on your show too. I mean, you know, yes, there are never that many of those people. But yeah, go on with the question, because I like this.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I don't know. I think a lot about whether or not I even want success if it requires what it seems to. You know, like, I have a complicated relationship with Los Angeles. I have a complicated relationship with the notion of success and with ambition.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I trust this idea that, like, you know, it's good to be hyper ambitious and hyper competitive and to want to win. And I'm like, well, A, what does that mean? What do you got to do to win? B, what are you winning?
What
are the costs that's involved?
Great. That is exactly the question that we should all ask. I mean, look, I think everybody who writes, or probably everybody who does anything, you know, certainly anybody who's listening to this particular conversation, you know, has some endeavor in their life where you feel like, you know, I you know, you have at least some reptilian part of your mind is like, ah, I really want to blow up. You know, I want this to be huge. I want my novel to sell, you know, 500,000 copies. You know, I don't know. You know, it's like you want something, right? I mean, there's a certain kind of ambition that's kind of wired into all human nature and all human endeavors. And yet the kind of the wages of success, of certain kinds of success, of sort of loud public facing success, are brutal. And I've never really seen them help anybody. I've never seen them help anybody creatively. I've never seen them help anybody personally. And I've seen and known a lot of people who have met that fate. You know, I've known, obviously, people in the movie business who've had that experience. I've known musicians, and I've known writers, you know, and whether it's, you know, writers who have had that experience quite young, like Brett Ellis, or, you know, I mean, we all, you know the sort of more contemporary analogs of, you know, people who win MacArthur Genius Grants, people who, you know, who win big literary prizes, people who, you know, whatever the people whose, you know, whose writings are turned into, you know, very successful films or television shows. It's like those people are all out there. And I suspect that almost all of them, speaking honestly, would tell you that is an experience they have had to survive. Not that it was a great or easy boon to their lives, although surely in many respects it was, but that it was also something that had to be navigated, something that had to be negotiated, something that kicked up complicated interior feelings. You know, I can't say what those feelings are because it hasn't happened to me, but I can guess. And a little more than guess, I can kind of feel them on the, you know, kind of inherent in even the kind of moderate success that I've experienced myself. And they're double-edged. In fact, there are more than two edges. They are like, you know, holding cubist razor blades in their serrations and in their problems.
So there's a great quote from Tuesday Weld in the Tuesday Weld essay in the book, and she's talking about actors that she's known, particularly those who are on the back half of their career, who have had a lot of success, but who are up in age. I think that's who she's referring to. And she said something that really struck me. And essentially, it is that she's never met a single one of them who is happy, basically.
She's talking about Orson Welles, I think, or she's extrapolating from her experience with making a movie with Orson Welles in 1971 called The Safe Place. And Orson Welles is kind of a perfect example of someone who, you know, it's easy to forget that when he came here to make Citizen Kane, he was the toast of the world, you know? And I think his passage from there over the latter decades of his life was very, very, very complicated. And I think Tuesday Weld, who I just love, and who's really, you know, along with Renata Adler, the one person I wrote about in the book and Tom McGuane, who's alive. I guess I would say the one person in the book who's alive who felt so mythic to me, I didn't reach out to her or want to kind of disturb her privacy. Like, I think she's the one person in the book who's alive, who doesn't know the book exists and may never, which, you know, kind of just gives me a kind of strange frisson in talking about her or thinking about her role in the book. I feel in a lot of ways like, as someone who was famous and, you know, and always also considered maybe a little bit of a, you know, famous, but never quite living up to whatever her promise was, you know, she was supposed to have had. Never mind that she didn't appear to have any interest in whatever that promise was, that it didn't seem to have anything to do with who she was or is. And now I don't think she's worked in, I don't think she's acted in anything in at least 15 years, which is a really fascinating place. It's like, you know, an artist who kind of had this long career and who still has an ordinary life that I don't know anything about.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a theme running from essay to essay or section to section. This book is a hybrid in the truest sense. I mean, I didn't even know what to call it. It's an essay collection. It's a memoir. It's a collection of cultural criticism. And I think it's interesting and true to life, especially for creative people, how, as you're writing about kind of midlife crisis stuff, you know, you had gone through a divorce, you were living alone, helping to raise your daughter, but, you know, struggling to find your way at this stage of life and thinking a lot about the things that we've been talking about. You write about in the book, and I think we're doing this in your real life as well, turning to creative figures of interest and inspiration who became a kind of mirror for you and helped you to understand yourself better. And I think that's often how human beings do it, especially creative human beings. Like, yes, you can go to therapy. Yes, you can write in your journal. Yes, you can go for long walks in the forest or whatever. But more often than not, you know, I reach for a book, I think is my go-to, or I'll watch a movie. We look to art to try to find a map or to find some reflection of ourselves that can help us piece the puzzle together and make sense of things.
All the time. And, you know, and rarely directly, right? It's like, you know, I think it's fairly seldom do I pick up a book and think, this, I want this book to show me my way out, or my way through, or my way, you know, or to show me at all. But, you know, the constant feeding of oneself with art, which I do, and which I think all of us who are listening to this certainly do, is essential in that way. It's like, you know, it's not just showing us, you know, who we are, who we wish we were, or how to be, but some kind of weird combination of those things. It's showing us a spectrum of human possibility. And, you know, this book, which, you know, you mentioned the kind of some of the experiences of the personal experiences that lay behind it, a divorce, a dying parent, all that stuff. You know, I wanted to find a way to write about those things without writing about them, without, you know, God, I mean, you know, it's one thing I did not want this book to do. And I don't think it does. Hopefully it does not, is whine about or even just describe, you know, my own suffering or my own problems, which struck me even as I was in the thick of them as being incredibly ordinary. but to kind of use them as a kind of way of entering these wider worlds and wider questions posed by the people that the book looks at and thinks about.
Well, I think also, or I would have to imagine that by focusing on people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, I'll list some of the people that you're writing about, some of the artists, but F. Scott Fitzgerald, Carol Eastman, Tom McGuane, Hal Ashby, Michael Cimino. Is that Cimino? Am I pronouncing
Cimino.
That?
Yeah.
Yeah, Cimino. Warren Zevon. You know, by looking to these people and by using them as a kind of way in, I can imagine as a writer how that's a lot more appealing than simply dealing with what's going on in your head or in your heart.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I don't know. I've tried to write a book of a similar nature and it's excruciating and it's really hard to make it palatable for a reader. Like you realize like, A, how ordinary it is, as you said, but also like, my God, there's, it can be suffocating. There's not much relief there. You need a little bit of an excursion. You need to kind of ventilate the thing in order to make it readable.
Yeah. I mean, I have a kind of Baroque metaphor that I sometimes have in my head about this stuff where I think of, you know, a bullfighting metaphor where it's like, you know, I am the bullfighter, the book or the thing I am writing is the rag, and the kind of emotional impulses or feelings behind it are the bull. You know, and so the kind of, you know, there's always a kind of dance in which you're kind of, you know, keeping your own, or I'm always at least keeping my own, you know, my own kind of quotidian experience, my, you know, the kind of just boredom and suffering and, you know, all that stuff that we all kind of go through minute to minute and day to day, you know, that's, I'm so it's sort of, you know, making the book or the rag dance. but you know, if I stand directly behind it, the book or those feelings will, you know, will be impaled, will impale me.
So let's start with F. Scott Fitzgerald, since that's where you start the book.
Yeah. The you know, I will say about the people that are in the book was, you know, there were so many people that I considered writing about. There was a, you know, I kind of made this compendious list that was just almost impossibly long. And I wound up kind of winnowing them down, you know, in a way that was like a tarot deck. You know, it was like all of these people are genuinely important to me. And certainly in the way that they are described in the book, that is the case. But there was a selection involved and a sort of sense of like, you know, it wasn't going to be like all writers or all musicians or all filmmakers. I mean, it could have been, but I kind of chose, there was some interesting choice making based on kind of what sort of archetype each one offered. But Fitzgerald was always going to be there because he was, you know, crucial to me when I was a teenager. And also I think still represents, you know, the kind of the ultimate, right? The idea of Gatsby being the kind of ultimate American, avatar of a certain bogus kind of success or bogus self and self reinvention, and Fitzgerald himself being the kind of ultimate American avatar of a certain kind of, you know, a certain kind of ruin, a certain kind of collapse.
Well, I think one of the thing, like the themes running through the book, and you know, a theme that follows the choices that you've made in terms of who to write about, is that there is a sense of like lost possibility, like what might have been. Certainly that was the case for F. Scott Fitzgerald, who, you know, all of this posthumous success that he's enjoyed kind of covers up the fact that when he died, like, I want to say Gatsby was barely in print or had sold like 15 copies that year, and he thought it was a complete failure. In his mind, he was a complete failure. You know, like he had washed up.
I forget if this is still in the book, but he used to go, I think I had to sort of shorten that chapter a bit, but you know, he used to go into bookstores in LA and look for copies, which were very hard to find at the time. And once he did, and the the store owner was absolutely amazed to discover that Fitzgerald was still alive. You know, and he's like, oh my God, like, you know, you're still, you know, it wasn't like, oh my God, you're Scott Fitzgerald who wrote this book. It's, you know, oh my God, you're not dead. So yeah, he was really considered to be, you know, he was as aired out in that respect as anyone could imagine.
Yeah. And you write about that neighborhood. That's kind of my old neighborhood. When I first moved to Los Angeles, I lived in West Hollywood and was aware of the history, like at least that bit of history. There's so much I miss, but I knew that F. Scott Fitzgerald had died on Hayworth right there by the Directors Guild. And every time I go past it, I think of him. You know, he was what, 42 years old, 44?
44, yeah.
I mean, my God, I'm older than him. I've outlived F. Scott Fitzgerald, knock on wood.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's crazy to think of, like, what a meteoric ascent at such a young age, and then how quickly it ended for him.
And yet, this is in the book, too, and I think no one really talks about this, which is that the book he was writing when he died would have been his best novel, and it really isn't. You know, I mean, The Last Tycoon is so gorgeous, or The Loves of the Last Tycoon, I guess is what it's now called. But it's so different than his other work. You know, it's so kind of, there's a sort of sweetness to it, and a kind of calm that's mesmerizing. I mean, I just think that book is incredible, even as a fragment, you know, even as the sort of uncompleted novel that it is, it's perfect. I mean, I vastly prefer it to The Great Gatsby, which I realize is a slightly kind of contentious statement, but I really do.
I feel like F. Scott Fitzgerald had so much like raw, right? Like so much raw talent. Like, he couldn't write a bad sentence.
He had, in my opinion, much, much more raw talent than Hemingway ever did. You know, I mean, this is, again, kind of a sidebar, but I think, you know, he was, I don't know that he was, you know, you certainly can't quite call him as great as Faulkner, whose achievements were much vaster, but in terms of just talent and kind of understanding or negative capability is really what the book, you know, kind of settles upon, this kind of, you know, this ability to see things more than one way. I think that he really had more than any of his peers, you know, and of course what got in the way was his drinking.
Well, yeah. And I mean, he certainly could be a handful when he was drinking, and I'm, you know, I don't want to paint him to be a saint, but my understanding of him based on what I've read is that he was a nice guy, in ways that maybe Hemingway wasn't always. I know, you know, people are complicated. I'm sure they had great aspects and not so great aspects, but is that the wrong read on Fitzgerald?
No, I think it probably is. I mean, look, I think that there are people, you know, people who are great partisans of Zelda, Fitzgerald, who believe that he stole her work or stole ideas. You know, I can't speak to the complexities of that relationship. And, you know, I do know that like many brutal alcoholics, he was really, charmless would it be about the kindest thing you could say about him when he was on a, you know, in his cups. But I do think that there was a fundamental decency there. You know, he did look after, take care of Zelda, you know, pay for her medical upkeep and write to her constantly. And the same with Zelda, with Scotty, with his daughter, with their daughter. I think he was, you know, a complicated, but in many ways, decent father. I think he was, a decent man who was, less decent when he was, in the grips of his addiction.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm now recalling, I want to say it's like Kate Zambrino's Heroines, that book where I read about, like, you know, how he got a lot of his ideas from Zelda. I think there's some truth to that. The modernist women, I feel like there's some truth to the, you know, the ways in which a partnership or a marriage, especially one that's peopled by two creative people.
Yes.
And especially in that era, could involve like theft and oppression.
There is, for sure. I mean, look, I think that's unquestionable. You know, I'm sure that Zelda's contributions to his work were greater than he acknowledged, or greater than were acknowledged, just broadly speaking, too, because of the era, and because that's the way it's often been for artists who are women, which is also in the book. But I think, was it theft? I'm a little less convinced of that. I am convinced that Zelda's own work deserved a far greater, kind of platform and far greater opportunity. But I don't know to what extent one can really persuasively paint Fitzgerald as the arch villain of her story either.
So, other people that you write about in the book, Carol Eastman.
Oh man.
This is one of the pitfalls of me, talking to somebody who's written a book of cultural criticism, is that like I read the book and I'm happy to have read it. And, especially in the context of my schedule, I'm like, yes, I got it done. But then there are so many things that you're talking about in the book that if I were to be a completist about it, I would have to watch or read or study up on. And I can find myself having to acknowledge my own cultural blind spots when I read books like this. And Carol Eastman would be one of them. I was like, man, and Frank and Eleanor Perry, like these are people that just missed me or I missed
those
them.
Those are not well known. I mean, I think those are people whose bodies of work are celebrated by film enthusiasts. But I think most people don't have any idea of who they are. And there's two things I'll note here. One of them is that, hopefully this book works without an encyclopedic knowledge of the people that are in it. Hopefully it will spur kind of curiosity to investigate those people at one's leisure, one's possibly non-existent leisure. And also, the sense that one's cultural blind spots are enormous. I mean, everybody's are. Mine are. It's just every day one wakes up and looks at the kind of catalog of world literature and world cinema that one knows nothing about and thinks, it's like my thimble full of knowledge is quarter full at best. It's just one of those things where, even if you've kind of devoted a lifetime to inhaling works of art, if you're honest, you will always know that what you've inhaled and what you've ingested is like the tiniest fraction of what one really ought to know.
Okay. So yeah, point taken. And I would have to agree. You have to kind of go easy on yourself at a certain point. There's nobody who can read it all or see it all or listen to it all. But right. I think also for the listener, I want to underscore the fact that it was entirely satisfying for me to read about and learn about Carol Eastman, just as an example, having not come to the book with a great working knowledge or any working knowledge.
Yeah.
So just for people listening, like you don't have to know to thoroughly enjoy it. I think to your credit, you raise these people to a kind of like mythic status, like to the point where like I'm like, oh my God, I got to go watch Five Easy Pieces again. And I'm like searching the internet for Carol Eastman. There's not much out there.
Very
and
little, yeah.
I want to talk about that in particular because I think what makes her such a fascinating figure is not only the talent and the fact that she crossed paths with a lot of people that we would know about. Like she was kind of there at the beginning with Jack Nicholson and
very, very involved with Jack and also with Warren Beatty. Never romantically with either of them, which I feel like is kind of a sterling achievement unto itself. Just considering how relentless the sort of seductive men who surrounded her were sort of known to be, but yeah, she had a lot of interesting intersections in that way.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, like obviously, and that's part of her allure and what makes her compelling. But I think what makes her most compelling is the fact that she was so interested in anonymity in a town where everybody is striving for pretty much the exact opposite. And this wasn't like a passing phase or some sort of put on. Like she really didn't want the limelight.
Apparently not. And just her kind of reluctance to be photographed was a big thing. She did not like cameras. She did not like airplanes. I mean, a lot of those things are true. And I think, it's part of her work is so so remarkable. And, you know, what's frustrating is that the best of it is in a, you know, is in boxes at the Perry Ransom Center in Texas. I have no idea whether anyone other than myself and the person who originally archived them has ever gone through them. One thing I did discover after writing the book was that, or very late in the game while I was finishing it, is that Michael Silverblatt, the great KCRW host, was Eastman's closest friend for many years. And so so he had kind of wonderful remembrances and you know, information about her that, that you know, I wish I could have interpolated more of that into the book, but you know,
so he was, but he was forthcoming. You got to talk to him about her.
Yeah, I did. But you know, he really adored her and really, really, you know, I think considers her correctly. I would say too, to have been an enormous genius. Someone who's kind of, you know, produced and available work represents the kind of barest flakes off of an incredibly, deep, sensibility and talent.
You know, and I used to live on the same street as her. I lived on Westmount back in
the
day.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. For like a couple of years. When I met my wife, I was living on Westmount. When did Carol Eastman die? She died...
2006. Could have been 2003.
Okay. But she wasn't... Was she living on Westmount in those days or no?
I think so, yeah. I think that's where she was at the end.
Jesus. So I was her neighbor. And like Warren Zevon died on King's Road... I could have, I didn't know, you know, I'm walking around these neighborhoods. I have no idea who my neighbors are.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a thing, but that's a thing that I think is, you know, hopefully the book kind of, this is a kind of, you know, impression that it will leave, you know, there's something beautiful about, you know, the kind of ghost presences of artists or kind of our understanding that what we see, what we read represents, I mean, you know, and everybody who's ever written a book knows this, that it's like, you know, that you're kind of pressing this book out into the world and there's just like an entire life or years of labor that kind of precede it and years of life that precede it. And, you know, and I think part of the kind of pleasure of focusing in many cases on some of these lesser known artists is just that kind of wonderful sense that like, there's always somebody, there's always more out there for you to find, you know, and not just kind of stuff in the future to find, but like, you know, there's always, you know, art from the past or the present that is kind of happening outside one's ken. And I find that notion incredibly consoling. You know, that one doesn't just sit there and kind of wait for Entertainment Weekly to kind of push its most anticipated books of the fall list out into the world, to know what to read. You know, there's always so much wonderful work that one hasn't found yet.
Okay, and along the lines of Carol Eastman and Hollywood screenwriting, something that haunts me and that I wonder about is how many great scripts, unproduced, are shelved somewhere in this town or have been put into a paper shredder or live on somebody's hard drive?
Thousands, literally thousands.
And they're masterpieces waiting to be made.
Yes, or masterpieces. You know, the one that I've been dying to read, you know, you mentioned Carol Eastman. Carol Eastman's brother, Charles, who was also a kind of fascinating and incredible writer, whose body of work or body of available work is even smaller than Carol Eastman's. He wrote a script, apparently, that was started circulating in the early 60s called Honey Bear, I Think I Love You, which is strangely similar to the more recent Father John Misty album title. So I've always wondered whether he stole it, but apparently this script was, I mean, for decades, even in the last decade, I think Sean Penn had his hooks in it and was kind of looking to do something with it. That script is the script that, that Robert Towne credits with, you know, he sort of said, oh, I read that script and, you know, in the 60s and it opened up a whole vernacular of writing for me. I didn't realize that screenplays could do that. You know, there's very little information about it. Apparently, you know, I read it somewhere described as an emotionally disturbed young man's attachment to a high school girl or something like that, which sounds a little gross and creepy, maybe a lot gross and creepy, like Lolita-like. But maybe it's more like a kind of reverse Harold and Maude. I mean, you know, it's hard to know. But, you know, that's a perfect example of a script. I think there's a copy of it at a library in Bowling Green, Ohio, I believe, that I would like someday to get my hands on. I'm sure there are other copies of it too, but you can't find it. It's not, you know, it's nowhere on the internet or anything like that. It's just out there in the archives. And, you know, as we know, you know, the number of great films in the world is dwarfed by the number of great unproduced films that could have been.
Well, that's what I mean. Cause I, like, whenever I see a great film, I marvel at it, I think, more than I marvel at a great novel, simply because of the human politics involved in getting a movie made.
Yes.
It's amazing to me that a good one is ever made. It's amazing that a great film has ever been made, considering what hell it is to get a movie made.
Well, it's the kind of thing that really should maybe give us like the barest inkling of hope for democracy. And I mean, I know that sounds kind of insane, but what I mean is that, you know, generally when you, you know, it's almost impossible to get a plurality of people to kind of unify around a goal and achieve that goal in ways that aren't just, you know, that aren't just successful, but which might actually kind of transcend the sum of its parts, right? You know, that's almost impossible. It's like, you know, there are many movies and even many great movies that you can kind of go, oh, you know, that's actually flawed by, you know, like such and such a performance. You know, too bad the script isn't quite as good as everything else. But every once in a while, there's one that comes along and you think, holy shit, that's so much greater than any of its parts. You know, it transcends those parts to become something, you know, even more majestic than that. And, you know, that's an amazing thing. And yeah, I feel that way about movies too. It's incredible that people are ever able to make a great piece of art in concert.
I think I guess if I were to give credit or to point to what, like one of the parts, you know, that is most crucial in the assembly, I guess it's the director, because certain directors seem to be able to create that magic on a somewhat consistent basis, or at least on a repeat basis. But then, you know, without the script, what are they going to do? And
yeah, I would actually say the interesting thing, because of course, you know, we still kind of fetishize directors on some level, and you know, not entirely wrongly so. It's like a Robert Altman or a Scorsese, or you know, it's like these are, they do it again and again and again. They deserve it, you know. But of course, movies are a collaborative medium. No director can do anything alone. Great directors tend to have repeat collaborators a lot of the time, which I think is telling, you know, and some of those collaborators are, you know, what that, I don't just mean like they might work repeatedly with the same actors or, you know, or more than once with the same writer. They also frequently work with the same cinematographer, the same editor, you know, and I think, you know, film editors are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. They're the, you know, I think anybody who ever had the good luck to work with someone like Walter Murch, who should be as much of a household name as you know, as some of those directors, would agree with this. You know, it's directors deserve a lot of credit, but I think almost never do they deserve quite as much credit as they reap by themselves.
Yeah, they're like the quarterback of the football team or whatever.
Yeah. You know,
all the glory, yeah. but also if the movie tanks, like with Michael Cimino in Heaven's Gate or whatever, like,
yeah, they wear it. They wear the failure of it. That's exactly right. But although not always, you know, sometimes, I mean, I think, you know, there's that Carol Eastman movie, The Fortune, Mike Nichols directing a Carol Eastman script starring Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty. The movie was a failure. It has some interesting things to recommend it, but it's, you know, it's not a great movie quite, although the Coen brothers and other people think that it is. But it is Eastman who wore the egg on that one. It was just like, oh, you know, she wrote a bad script. The script wasn't that good. And, you know, the script probably had problems, in its reduced form, which is what they shot. But it's also like, well, no, the failure got pushed off on the least powerful person in the room.
You know, it's interesting to talk about movie failures because I can sometimes enjoy in the weirdest way a train wreck of a movie, and I think I'm viewing it through the lens of a creator.
Yeah.
I'll point to like a recent example where I'm like trying to fall asleep, I'm flipping channels, and I land on this like teen romance movie called Take Me Home Tonight. And it was like, oh God, like Topher Grace, I think was the actor, and nobody else that I know. I don't know anybody else in the movie, but like, I don't know. Those kinds of movies can be kind of like comfort food or something, like teen movies, or, you know, kind of hearkening back to the movies of my childhood, you know, like
absolutely. And I think that's another, you know, this is another thing, which is that, you know, not everything, I think, you know, a life that is full only of masterpieces, you know, or a life where you're sort of like, I only want to watch the great, I only want to read the sort of, you know, towering canonical classics. I only want to watch this, you know, that's like a life without cheeseburgers. You know, what kind of life is that at all?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think, and there's also places in this book where I discuss a lot of art, maybe even most of the stuff in the book is, you know, involves stuff that's flawed or stuff that is imperfect. And I think, you know, that can be the best.
Well, this movie, like the what became interesting to me as I was watching it, cause it really does not work, like profoundly. Yeah. So like it does not work. And
yeah,
I mean, you know, it's like watching a train wreck to some extent, but it's an interesting train wreck because I think, and I could be wrong, but it felt like the director was trying to make like a less than zero kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Like the characters are doing cocaine, or at least one of the characters is. There's this whole cocaine like B story.
right.
And you're like, but it doesn't really come off accurately. Like it's sort of goofy and like weird and, I don't know. And I got sort of like invested in this, like, well, what was going on behind the scenes and what did the original script look like? And, you know, you can start to kind of tease these things apart.
I love doing that sometimes. I mean, again, it's, you know, that can be the most rewarding kind of watch where you're just like, what are they going for here? And you kind of start to see what they're looking for, but the pieces are obviously in conflict. You know, I got lost the other night watching a movie that no one talks about, a 1965 Warren Beatty movie called Mickey One, which is not by any, you know, it's just not really a good movie, but it's amazing. I mean, it's like you can sort of be like, oh, it's like he was trying to do Truffaut and he was kind of trying to do A Hard Day's Night and he was kind of trying to do Fellini, like, you know, and there's this kind of weird like Chaplin-esque quality to it. And you're just like, this is a mess, but it's also kind of incredible.
Right,
I love it.
Right. So I want to talk to you a little bit. I mean, we can't get to everybody, but I want to talk to you about Warren Zevon.
Yeah, please.
Because, you know, I'm a fan of his music. His music, you know, you are as well. And his music has kind of played a role in your life, and especially at a pivotal moment. There's a really poignant scene where his music factors in. But, you know, kind of like the other figures in the book, there is a sense of what might have been. Warren Zevon as a rock star is a particular kind of figure, kind of never made a bad album. Critics always loved him, had the respect of his peers, but never really busted out and became like, you know, a Springsteen or a Bob Dylan or, you know, one of these like major rock star figures. You know, he was always,
and I'm sure that bothered him. Yeah, of course. Or at least I would expect that it did. Right. I mean, that weird spot of being kind of like famous adjacent, or sort of like being the guy where you kind of like, you know, he comes out to LA in the '70s and the Eagles are playing on his records and Linda Ronstadt is like recording his songs and making hits out of them. You know, and he must have felt then like, oh, you know, it's all happening. I'm the man. And, you know, and then other than kind of Werewolves of London, the one song everybody knows, it didn't happen for him. And he had 30 years of recording. And of course, all of his kind of, you know, personal and characterological problems, which are also in the book. You know, I think of that chapter as being one that kind of meditates a little on that sticky question of our times. You know, what do you do with great art by people who are themselves not so great in their private lives.
Yeah, I was just talking about this on the show with a recent guest named Greg Gierke, who's also written some cultural criticism.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, like, Woody Allen is like the, you know, a obvious example, but you could point to any number of people. I think we were pointing to Marlon Brando, and I don't know. Not many people can survive under the microscope, but some of their, you know, some of these people, their offenses are really grotesque. And like, what do you do? And it's a, I guess it's a good question. I think I sort of fall into the camp that the art and the artist have to live separately. Otherwise you're going to be in a never ending process of burying. I mean, like, how much art is even going to be watchable? Like, I don't know how many.
Well, there's certainly that question, right? Because I think Woody Allen is the, I've vowed on social media and elsewhere never to wade into Woody Allen discourse. You know, I have my own opinions about what transpired there, and those opinions have changed across time, and they haven't really affected my view of his films, which I was very fond of when I was younger, and now I find even the ones I liked don't quite hold up for me as movies, at least not the way that movies I care more about do. But I think, you know, I think we are in a kind of very, very intense time where the kind of legacy of every artist is being aggressively reassessed, you know, and one can decide for oneself whether one thinks it's being reassessed fairly or being reassessed hyper aggressively. And I sort of have a feeling that, you know, over the span of human history, those reassessments will themselves be reassessed. And we might gain a kind of more flexible sense of context, regain a more flexible sense of context. You know, I think it's very tricky for me to try to judge, you know, people who were acting badly in accordance with the shitty standards of 1971 by the standards of 2021. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, people tend to behave in harmony or in conflict with the standards, you know, with the behavioral standards of their time. But I think it varies from artist to artist for me. You know, there are some artists where I think, well, they are a little diminished. The art is a little diminished for me by knowing what I know about them personally. You know, there are other instances where, I mean, Roman Polanski is kind of a perfect example where it's like, you know, obviously he statutorily raped a teenager. That's not acceptable in any world. But also those movies are masterpieces. I'm not living in a world where I'm not watching Chinatown or The Tenant or Knife Slits Water or, you know, Repulsion. You know, they're masterpieces, and to say otherwise is ridiculous, and to sort of deprive yourself of them because he was a very problematic man is an okay thing to do, but it's, you know, you're losing something in doing that, I think.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't know. I've been like arguing with myself lately where I'm like, well, if somebody's done something that terrible, like maybe you don't like bury all the art and deprive yourself of the art, but maybe they shouldn't have the opportunity to continue at their current station, you know, like being able to make movies and get financed, and unless there's some sort of, penance, you know, unless there's a real admission of guilt and a time served kind of thing. I don't want to bury somebody forever if they're genuinely sorry or something. But I, you know, there are certain things that I don't think you should be able to come back from. And
yeah, I think that there's all kinds of collapse around this question. Like I agree with you. There are some things you should be able to come back from. There's some things you shouldn't. There are people who should not be able to continue to earn a living or earn what they have. You know, there are other people who I think probably have been slightly overpunished or even more than slightly overpunished for aggravated misdemeanors or less complex felonies. We'll call them that. I don't mean that literally. I mean, you know, on the kind of moral scale of things. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of confusion around that question, more than we'll be able to solve in this conversation for sure. But yeah, I think that there are varying you know, it all kind of exists on a one's tolerance for that is a personal matter.
Yeah, and I think like just in the context of somebody like Zevon, who you know bared his soul in his music, obviously a very complicated guy, but I can find myself, especially when somebody is seen in the context of their times, but also who is so clearly struggling with addiction.
Yes.
I can find myself at least taking that into account when it's like, oh, well, he threw a potted plant at somebody. Well, it's like, yeah, he was like, you know, coked up and wasted. You know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Like,
yeah, that's exactly right. That's very different than the same act sober. And I think, you know, in Zevon's case too, where, you know, the songs themselves are so mordant and dark and, you know, he certainly doesn't let himself off the hook in any of them. You know, I mean, I think that's sort of the point of them. You know, he remains such an incredibly, he's just such a startlingly wonderful songwriter. You know, it's amazing. Just certain couplets, you know, you can't let go of. You hear them once and they're with you forever.
And such a funny guy too. His work had such great wit, or has such great wit. And I think, you know, since we've talked about Carol Eastman and Warren Zevon, I don't know if they're the only two subjects in the book who are from Southern California. But
yeah, that's a good McGuane is not, the Perrys are not, Ashby was not, Cimino was not, Renata Adler certainly was not, Tuesday Weld.
No, she was back east. She was back east.
Yeah, that's right. Right. They came out. So yeah, that's
but
it.
They have great, I mean, these personal histories, like Zevon, I did not know. So it was fun for me to read and find out about where he came from, like his father and like his possible gangster connections.
Stumpy.
And it makes sense. It made Warren Zevon, you know, it was like, oh, of course. Like, it didn't surprise me at all to learn that he had come up in L.A., you know, mid-century with a father who was kind of a touch shady, shall we say.
He owned a carpet store. That's the other thing, or a rug store. That was Stumpy's front business, at least, was that he owned a carpet store, which I love.
Yeah, yeah, this is great.
Yeah.
I want to get back to talking about success and failure and the multifaceted nature of any place, but especially a place as big as Los Angeles. I was having a conversation with a friend just a day or two ago and was kind of lamenting the fact that, you know, Hollywood can often seem to reward assholes.
It used to, and I guess even as recently as Armie Hammer, it has continued to, but less and less. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. And for the good, but it like requires, I think I was like lamenting like does success in this town, especially in the entertainment industry, require a certain like psychosis? Like, do you have to be hyper competitive and do you have to have a kind of cold-bloodedness? And then we started talking further, and it was like, you know, there's so many obviously good and decent people who come into this business and who might get turned by it because there are cultural norms within the business that might be pretty inhuman, but that become accepted and widely practiced, and we were wondering at why. And then we started talking about Harvey Weinstein, Scott Rudin, figures like this who, you know, at least in my adult lifetime, if you think about the movies that people like you and I would probably gravitate towards and admire, so much of it, not all of it, obviously, but so much of it has flowed from guys like that, like these who...
Yes. Yes, right.
For all of their talents, you know, are kind of monstrous in their personal behavior. And if they're the ones on high who are setting the tone, like, it makes sense to me that you would have like a kind of a pervasive toxicity, like that it would spread and that it would become sanctioned in a way.
Yes, for sure. And it's interesting that those two who really are, you know, I think there are plenty of monstrous people in Hollywood, but those are the two of the biggest over the last couple of decades. And it's interesting that those would have been the ones to sort of be you know, keepers of a certain kind of highbrow, strand of filmmaking, you know, and obviously this business has always attracted broken people. I don't think that's entirely unique. In other words, I think the world is crawling with broken people, and you know, the broken most ones are often the ones with the most ambition or the most kind of compensatory drive, you know, to become successful in certain ways. You know, I'm optimistic that the business is becoming a lot less hospitable, you know, possibly even terminally inhospitable to that kind of behavior. I think, but you know, yes, I do think that, you know, just by nature of the fact that people who are suffering, people who think ill of themselves or who are kind of driven to escape, you know, aspects of their history that they are uncomfortable with, you know, those are people that often do have the kind of drive to come here and to make art in general, right? I don't know how much art is made by people that are altogether healthy, which is, you know, I mean, it's again, healthy is a kind of a weird word. It's such a, I don't, you know, I'm uncomfortable with it because I think, you know, I don't know what standards of health attain, but you know, for whatever reason, our culture at large and our capitalist culture is broken in ways that facilitate that have always facilitated different kinds of abuse.
Well, and okay, and agreed. And I think sometimes in my more sour moods, I can want to paint with that broad brush and just be like, this whole place is fucked. And yeah. it's like a petri dish full of disease and all the ways we could characterize it. But you, as somebody who, you know, was born and raised here and grew up in a quote unquote Hollywood family and kind of had a ringside seat to some extent to this culture, you know, this entertainment industry culture through the work of your father and to some extent your mother, you know, you don't have to look any further than your own dad to know that somebody can work through the system or whatever you want to call it and retain a fundamental decency.
Yes. My father is a very, very, very decent man, which is astonishing considering the world that he's, you know, lived in and worked in for, you know, more than half a century. You know, and I think that's helped me. Both of my parents were really very, very ethical people. You know, very, very imperfect people, very, very ethical people. And you know, likewise, I think that, you know, it's funny that I think about this book and I think the book kind of makes this explicit too, is, you know, by the time you get to the end of it, it's not really about the movies at all. It's about a certain kind of moral and maybe even spiritual education. You know, and those questions, of course, are the questions of art. you know, those questions of how to be, and I was thinking this morning about how, you know, the question that this book kind of opens with is the question that, you know, that every artist and every young artist probably has, which is, you know, what is art going to do for me? You know, if I write this book, will I blow up? How do I succeed in that regard? You know, and how, certainly for me now, you know, the questions in writing things tend to revolve a little bit more around what are my responsibilities in writing this? You know, to whom am I responsible? You know, to what are the rights and responsibilities that come with being a work of art, being a working artist, and how that's kind of, you know, that's what growing up is. I think that's a much more adult question than, you know, how do I become successful?
Yeah. It's interesting to say that your book is about your own moral and spiritual education. I think I sensed that as I was reading, but I never maybe said it as explicitly to myself. But it's working on deep levels and it's got a lot of heart in it. And I found, I think, most touching the parts of it where you were getting honest about just like this sense of expectation that we might have for ourselves in our younger years and how that might not match up with how things go, which I think is the case for most all of us. But then also, a moral and spiritual education, but also I think an attempt to understand not just yourself, but in particular your mother better, to get to a place of understanding and forgiveness, maybe by looking through the lives of some of the art, you know, the artists that we've touched on, you know, and some that we haven't.
Yeah. I mean, this goes far outside the question of art. You know, we, when we are children and when we are children, I mean, not just literal children, but when we are, you know, in our lives as the children of other people, we so often kind of look at, you know, these moments of cruelty or disappointment or, you know, being let down by our parents as if those are the things that comprehensively define who they are, instead of, you know, just experiences, you know, and probably regrettable ones, you know, that they were for our parents as people. You know, and I think all of us have had the experience of, you know, your child will say something and, you know, your response will be suboptimal. Hopefully not, you know, not like my mom, won't involve like projectiles and abusive verbal tongue lashings. But, you know, there are moments where you kind of go, God, I wish I hadn't said that, or I wish I had been a little bit, you know, I wish I had been more present in that moment or that moment. You know, it's completely different. It's like you understand that being a parent for everybody is only a part of who you are for everybody who is a parent, you know, and that it's, you know, that it's very hard to harmonize that part of your life sometimes with, you know, with the rest of it, you know, and so, yeah, that the book definitely looks at my mother in that way and sort of tries to find, you know, a more expansive view of her than I had when I was a teenager and she was drinking like a, you know, maniac and behaving not so well.
So there is a period in your life, I guess it would have been in your 20s when you lived in New York and you were working for whom you refer to as the actor.
Yes. yes. The actor in that case, I mean, it's funny, the book conceals a few identities and in one or two cases, it's sort of meant to, for personal reasons, it's meant to be somewhat blurry. But in that case, it's supposed to be fairly clear that the actor is De Niro, which is who it was.
Okay, because I was going to say, I was going to go just jump in and say, I think it's De Niro. You don't have to confirm or deny.
It's definitely De Niro, and there, you know, some of these periods will be addressed in the book that I'm writing now. So that yes, it was, that's who it was.
Okay, so to continue along this thread of like success and failure, you know, these yeah. themes, you know, I think. We're working your way towards the writing career that you have now, but for a long time, you know, you weren't there, and we're feeling like you weren't where you wanted to be, which again, yeah. totally relatable. But I think for some people looking at your life, like some readers would look at your life and be like, wow, like if this is failure, you know, this guy's working for De Niro, or he's you know, he's living in, you know, Santa Monica, you know, to somebody who might be, you know, from a different background or lives in a place that's maybe not quite so dynamic and exciting, it could seem like a pretty good option. yeah. But I think at the same time, being that close to people who have this kind of mega success, like, you know, working for De Niro and having proximity to his world, in Lower Manhattan, especially, which is like his home turf and all that kind of stuff, might actually heighten one's sense of failure because you're able to see the gulf, you know, the divide.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can say a few things about that. One, you know, I will say one sense of success. I mean, the kind of the weirdest thing about it for everybody is that most people don't even know when they have it or to what extent they have it. You know, and I think that's particularly true for writers, where, you know, everybody sort of says, oh, you know, I don't have this or I don't have that. You know, you're constantly kind of looking at the accolades you don't have. And, you know, I mean, I am aware that, you know, by any reasonable contemporary standard, like I am a success as a writer. I was even while I was writing this book. But I also think that, you know, that kind of like mega standard that gets set around the movies, and not just in the movies, right? It's like by now the whole media ecosystem kind of revolves around certain notions of success. And, you know, working for someone like Bob, I have to call him Bob, but I don't want to pretend. You know, I mean, I was you know, an employee of his. I was not his buddy. I was not palling around in his retinue. You know, there were you know, people above me, people between me and him, that kind of thing. But certainly when I worked for him, you know, the impression that I had was that he was a very, and I'm sure this is still true, you know, a private person and an actor and someone who was, you know, acutely uncomfortable with, you know, the kind of business of being a celebrity. You know, I don't think that was really ever a thing that interested him very much. You know, I think he was interested in acting, in the art of being an actor. You know, that was an interesting lesson too, I think. I think even at the time I might have been looking at him and sort of thinking, oh, you know, that's a standard of success, albeit not one that I ever aspired to personally, but also looking at him and sort of thinking, oh, you know, that is an artist in conflict with certain expectations that have been placed there by success.
I always found it sort of charming how bad he was or has been in interviews.
Yeah, because I don't think he likes to give them. I think he's a shy. I think he's a very shy person. I mean, again, I don't pretend to know him well enough, certainly, to have any kind of right to define him, in, you know, to other people. But my impression was of someone who was fundamentally pretty shy.
So, when it comes to especially like the world of Hollywood and the maintenance of one's dignity, there are people who can do it. Your dad pulled it off. Tom Hanks. He's like the paragon of like nice Hollywood celebrity, you know, maybe to a degree that probably annoys him, but I think he's a nice guy. And
I would argue that plenty of people have done it. I think George Clooney has done it. And I think loads of people who aren't stars, which is, by the way, most of the people who work in Hollywood, have also managed it.
Okay, but for people, you know, at a high level of success and maybe who are dealing with the spotlight or just like tons and tons of money.
Yes.
The question becomes like how? Like what is it that allows you? Maybe they just were raised well and they have a certain moral code that's etched into them from the jump that they've been able to carry forward, or I'm wondering if you have any insight into that, having borne closer witness than most people to people in this business and actors and, you know, high level people.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think being able to kind of insulate yourself a little bit, or maybe even more than a little bit from, I feel like I talked about that. I just, somebody asked me a similar question recently. And I think having a certain dedication to things that aren't just the trappings of success, you know, I mean, you know, whether that's really like a real fixation on the work itself, you know, you know, or something outside that. It could be a family, it could be, you know, any number of things, but you know, some area of focus, real focus, like primary focus outside the business of movie making. I think that's probably the first key constituent. You know, and I think there's also just a kind of fundamental quality of temperament, you know, probably having enough clarity that you are inclined to really pay attention or listen to other people, you know, that's probably helpful. You know, I think what kind of dooms you is if you aren't fully anchored in the work as an artistic pursuit and you don't have, other attachments, other forms of attachment, that can sort of, you know, keep your focus, scaled on a human level, that's when I think you're in trouble. And I think very, very few people, maybe nobody, kind of makes it through the mouth of the machine if they don't have those things without being deformed by it.
I think too, or I've had the thought in the past that having close friends and family, like a circle of people around you who you can rely on to tell you when you're full of shit.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, that's part of what I'm talking about. Having a system or having a relational arrangement where you do not where you are not magnified, where your day-to-day behaviors and decisions are mirrored back to you in some way that allows them to retain their reality and their sense of scale. You have to have people who are able to say no to you. And I think that becomes a problem. You know, I think a lot of actors, a lot of people who get into one thing and, you know, and then people are sort of telling them, why don't you write a book or why don't you make an album? And nobody is really telling them, like, don't do that. It sucks.
Right.
No. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine anything worse than having nobody around me who has either the courage or the insight to tell me when I'm being a jackass. Like, that's a dangerous place to be. And I can also very easily imagine how it could happen. You know, somebody gets super famous and super wealthy. I mean, there's nothing but people lining up to be yes men and yes women. You know, like there's plenty of people who will happily take that role.
That's exactly right. You know, I watched a kind of documentary the other night on the Criterion Channel about Dennis Hopper. And, you know, and it's fascinating. Hopper's a pretty amazing dude, but there's definitely some footage and some sort of glimpses of him right after Easy Rider had blown up. And, you know, you're kind of looking at the people that he's hanging around and the people that are close to him at that time and just thinking, this is bad. You know, everybody's just trying to, you know, butter him up minute to minute, hour to hour. And the consequences of it don't come out that brightly.
Yeah, he had a rough period, right? But I think like maybe later in his career,
very much. I think he you know, Blue Velvet really restored him as an actor, and you know, and it's not that he didn't do some great work, but the 70s were a real wilderness period for him. That's for sure.
Well, we all have our wilderness periods, right? Or most of us do. The good ones.
we do. And I mean, and we should. I mean, if you've never had one, I think that's not helpful. You know, there are certain humiliating and leveling experiences that we should all have, and almost all of us do. I mean, I think if you don't, you're either not living honestly or you're you know, so lucky as to be basically cursed beyond hope.
Well, okay, that's an interesting point, because I think on the surface, most of us would think, like, you know what, I'd love to have tons and tons of success and fame and money and be insulated from a lot of, like, the trivial suffering that characterizes most human existence. You know what I'm saying? To have the house with a pool and the nice car and not have to worry about all the bullshit of day-to-day. And yet, I think that there is, like, as you just said, there's a danger in that. And if you're struggling and you're suffering a lot, I do think it breeds empathy, or hopefully it does, but rather than bitterness, maybe a little of both, but I think it breeds empathy.
It doesn't always, but it can. And it may be the only thing that really does. That's the thing. You know, it's like, I think that it's very hard to attain, empathy for nothing. Or perspective for nothing. I think I prefer empathy is one of those words that gets thrown around a lot, and I sometimes wonder about it. I think, you know, it's like the Princess Bride. Like, I do not think that word means what you think it means. perspective and a sense of kind of relational awareness. Yeah.
Well, and like, I think the flip of it is that if you're somebody who, you know, winds up in a really high station and has a bunch of success and gets a ton of money, even somebody who, you know, previously was well adjusted or had a sense of perspective or came from nothing, even somebody like that, I think a lot of money and success can have an amnesiac effect.
And 100%. Yeah.
And it can insulate you in ways that make you, even if you don't intend for them to, less able to recognize and relate to the suffering of others.
Yes, I think that's right. Or it just becomes invisible to you. I mean, I think that's a real problem with wealth inequality, with it, where I think, like, just a lot of these people have no fucking idea, you know, what most people experience. They don't know. You know, it's like that. It's like the which was it? it was Senior Bush, right? Who George Bush Senior, who once went to the supermarket, was absolutely flabbergasted by the operation of the automatic checkout. You know, the kind of machine that scans things. He couldn't believe that existed.
Right.
And it was like, dude, you know, that's, I think money can have an insulating effect. It's almost automatic once there's a certain amount of it involved. I mean, I've seen that with people and quite frankly, I've seen it even with, you know, not nearly to that extent, but you know, I think there are, you know, members of my own family who are, you know, doing all right and probably don't see what it's like for people.
I was having a similar conversation, conversation recently with a friend talking about family members and good people who just will say something that reveals a kind of blindness, and you're like, really? Did you really just say that? Did you really just suggest that, kind of casually saying, well, why don't you don't just do this? And it's like, well, I don't do that because I don't have $50,000 sitting around,
Yes, exactly.
It's like, exactly. What are you even talking about? Like, what world are you living in? You know, just casually, like, why don't you just, I don't know. I think people lose touch a little bit, even, if they don't intend to. And
yeah, but I think, to go back to the original point, I think, suffering and the reality of suffering and even just the reality of boredom, the reality of things that don't even rise to the level of suffering are still, but that are kind of things that we try to drown out. You know, these are the things that keep us in touch with experience that's more genuine.
So I really love this book, and it feels like the kind of book that you sort of inched along with and intuited your way through. I could be totally wrong. I'm wondering how it came together, because it does weave different strands. You know, there's the cultural criticism strand, the film history strand, the personal strand, the familial strand, like all these different kind of threads that you're braiding together.
I'm just
curious how you arrived at these choices and when the thing started to congeal into a whole that you could make sense of.
Yeah, I had written a novel after American Dream Machine that I was just not happy with. My agent liked it. Like, people seemed to be, we're ready to go with this. And I was like, I wasn't satisfied. And I had in mind, that I wanted to write a kind of hybrid nonfiction of some kind. I'd been reading lots of, I realized that everything that I had really been reading, or really loving, Sarah Manguso's books, Heidi Julowitz's The Folded Clock, even some of the fiction that I liked, like Rachel Cusk's outline novels, Hilton Al's The Women, that was a big one for me, which is part memoir, part criticism. I was reading these books and I was thinking, I like this better. Like, I was trying to figure out how to do that. And then, I kind of talked out the form, with my literary agent. We sold this book on proposal. I had in mind, like, okay, it's going to have, seven sections, and they're going to be about these, people in this order. Although it changed a little as I wrote it, I did like make at least one substitution. But I didn't, in terms of the actual, the actual form of the book, I had written the first chapter and nothing else when I sold it. So I kind of set out from there. And you're right in that beyond a kind of like approximate structural map of like, these are the seven sections and these are the people that it's about, there was no outlining involved or any of that. There never is for me. I struggle with outlining, and I think whether I'm writing a novel or the book that I'm writing right now, which is also, I sold a proposal, I have a kind of big structure for it. But it's a very long book, and it's I don't want to say a sustained improvisation. I mean, obviously there's a tremendous amount of editing and revising and course correcting that goes on, but I'm not an outliner. I sort of believe that a good piece of writing has a kind of internal logic that is discovered on the fly and that is unbreakable, that is packed into its first pages, pretty strongly. Like I think with everything I've ever written, it's like once I get the kind of first paragraph or the kind of opening, once I get the opening right, you know, the ending is nascent inside that beginning. It all kind of comes as one thing, but that I kind of have to unpack it in real time. So yeah, I started with that, you know, having written that chapter about Fitzgerald, which was longer when I first wrote it. And then I wound up kind of cutting it more or less in half for the actual book. And then just blew it out from there. And the surprising thing is that structurally, you know, there was a lot of sentence work, but it didn't really change from what that draft was. That I didn't do any real like meaningful structural rewriting.
That's interesting. So you saw it. You had a vision of like, yeah, and you knew the people that you wanted, like the terrain you wanted to cover.
Yeah, it came complete. I mean, or nearly complete. You know, the Tuesday Weld was, I wound up, she was someone that I changed my mind about. And I think I changed the order a little bit from what was in the proposal. I thought, oh, I'm going to write about this person for chapter two. And I wound up transposing it so that it was Eleanor Perry came first. You know, that you make those choices the way you do with any piece of writing. Like you come to a point and you think it's going to go one, you know, you've always thought, oh, I'm going to do this. And then you get to that point in the narrative and you're like, oh shit, I'm actually not going to do that. I'm going to do this other thing. So there was a fair bit of that, but you know, it came in one, you know, gesture, and it came reasonably quickly. I mean, I think I did wind up writing the book, you know, it took a little less than a year. But I would say that the novel that I threw away before it, like there's a lot of stuff there's a lot of kind of material that I junked from the projects that were previous to it. And even while I was writing the proposal that, you know, could be considered drafting towards it.
Sure. Sure. And like, what about discovery? Like, you know, it's, you have a, you know, this long gestation or the junked novel, which I think is part of the process of this book.
And for
then
sure.
Then you have the vision and the people that you want to cover. But I could feel in the text, especially around stuff, I think personal stuff, like a sense of you discovering in the writing, like new insights or seeing things in a new way.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's what one writes. I mean, that's certainly, you know, that's the only thing that I'm, you know, it's in the one hand, it's like, that's the one kind of principle that I try to guide my writing by. It's like, you know, if there's no insight in it for me on a kind of sentence to sentence level, then I can't write it. There's nothing there to be written, you know, you know? So, you know, and of course what you're always trying to do is create the kind of narrative frame that will allow you to experience that insight in the language as you write it. And I think that's why this book, which has its kind of unusual frame of being a memoir, being a piece of criticism, being kind of all these things at once, you know, that was what allowed it for me. Like, if, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to write or couldn't have written like, oh, I'm just going to write a straight memoir about my family, or, oh, I'm just going to write an essay collection about these people. You know, that didn't appeal to me. It was the kind of combination form where I thought, oh, you know, that's the insight can live within this kind of formal bracket, and I can allow that to kind of generate the sentences and the voice and the kind of moment to moment revelations of it.
It's a beautiful book at the sentence level. It's very lyrical, and frankly, like, it, you know, I don't mean to be silly, but it definitely evokes Fitzgerald to me. Like, it's a beautifully written book and captures this city very well, you know, especially in a contemporary context. You know, I think of my friend, I don't know if you know Duke Haney or if you...
Yeah, sure. I mean, I certainly know who he is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote a book called, I've had him on the show, but he wrote a book called Death Valley Superstars.
Yes. Yes.
And kind of, you know, not quite the same beat, but similar, where I love the fact that you're writing about all these people, or mostly, you know, a lot of these people who live in the shadows.
Yeah.
Either like the, you know, the actual behind the scenes, like a Carol Eastman, who's like totally out of picture, somewhat by her own hand, or the people who, you know, just might not have like that white hot spotlight on them. And Duke is writing about, you know, similar figures in entertainment. These people who who might have been, you know, people who had great promise but then flamed out or died young,
I can't wait to read that. I like what I know of Duke's work. I know I've read him and thought, yeah, this guy's good.
Well, and it's also like, especially living here and having a sense of the scale of the place and having a sense of the mathematics of the place. Like, there's only so many seats at the table. There's so many people trying to break through and have that Hollywood experience or whatever.
Right.
And so it's impossible, I think, to live here and have that kind of awareness and not become curious at a certain point about all the different lives that are unfolding that don't reach those heights, which is 99% of the lives that are unfolding.
Yes. And which I think are, you know, and I might add, you know, even the metaphor of reaching heights, which, you know, is the one that we would all use, I think, it feels suddenly very suspect to me, because I just think to myself, like, you know, there are so many things to aspire towards in living and in making art that aren't that.
Right.
You know, I mean, I would say almost everything that is interesting in the making of art is aspiring, you know, even, it may also be aspiring to that, but it certainly is not only aspiring to that. You know, I just think, you know, everything that I care about, or everything that interests me, is happening at the level of the room and not the arena, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you're interested in making art as opposed to getting people's attention. You know, that's kind of that kind of feels like a lot of the battle, you know, so much of the culture is focused on, you know, eyeballs and clicks and likes, and, you know, that's kind of a lot of the game these days. And I think it's hard to be invested in a serious way in that kind of game and also to make art. It seems like you have to make your choices.
Yeah, I think that's true. By the way, did you catch that little bit of pet noise? That was my dog.
Oh no,
wandering into the room. That felt like the moment of the BBC broadcaster with the babies.
Oh, right. I welcome pets on this program. I have no problem with a dog entering the frame or entering the soundscape.
With apologies too, I think we got one blurt from I don't know, my phone is in the other room. I guess it rang to my computer, but hopefully that won't disfigure this beautiful conversation too much.
No, not at all. And what was I saying? I was just talking about people living in the shadows.
Yes, right. And the people who live in the shadows of those people who are living in the shadows. That whole question about, you know, aspiring towards art as opposed to aspiring towards attention.
Right.
There's so much the attention economy, monetizing attention. You know, I see it all the time. It's like I open up my Twitter feed, which I sometimes wonder why it exists. And I just think, you know, it's an economic imperative for a lot of us too. It's like, you know, right. It's like, you know, it's something that people are needing in order to survive, which is itself, you know, depressing, right? None of us should have to, you know, panhandle for attention in order to eat. But I think, you know, it's just not compelling to me, that the concept of just trying to magnetize attention for the sake of magnetizing attention. Not at all.
Yeah. And that makes me so, so pissed off to think about the ways in which these social media companies sort of have us. Like, you need them. Like, they know you need them. You know?
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
I don't want to have to need Facebook or, you know. Ugh.
No, Jesus, no. You know, and I dare to imagine that if there exists a future at all, it is a future in which that is not the case.
Right.
Because I think any future that continues to hinge upon one's ability to grab attention is going to be very short for the planet. So there you have it.
Or just for human happiness. I mean, it just doesn't strike me as happiness making.
No, it's kind of it's completely dystopic and undesirable.
So may I ask what you're working on? You alluded to it earlier in the conversation. You said it's a long book. Is it a novel or?
No, I mean, it's funny because it's like, it is, you know, also about my family and about the kind of motion picture business one more time. after this, I'll probably have to at least hit pause and write about a different slice of the world. But it is in many ways the story of how the motion picture industry, or this, you know, the movies as we understood them, right? The movies as a kind of central cultural fact of American life, how they died, how they lived and died. And I think by now, you know, look, I'm, you know, to say the movies are dead is like saying the novel is dead, or, you know, it's like it's not true. And I'm not really interested in kind of relitigating the kind of Scorsese, you know, are Marvel Comics movies art or not? You know, they're art to somebody, and that certainly makes them art. But I think we can all pretty much agree that what the movies were to the 20th century, the streamers and the internet are to the 21st. You know, so it's really about, you know, how that world collapsed. It's not, you know, it's, in other words, so it's a kind of very broad cultural history, but it's also a very intimate and in many ways much more kind of traditional narrative, you know, kind of memoir, narrative memoir than this book is. And yet it moves and it reads, at least to me, like a novel. You know, it's very concerned with story. It's very concerned with scene work in a way that this book isn't. You know, it's a big 75-year-long epic odyssey in which some of the people are famous and some of the people are obscure, and some of them are just me and my sister and my parents. it's a weird book. I mean, I've really kind of finally fallen in love with it after a year and a half of scrapping. It was supposed to be due in about a week and a half, and I finagled a long extension, which I badly need from Echo. So I'll be working on that for the next year at least.
Is this the golden hour or no?
Yeah, it's called, the working title is the golden hour. Whether that title will stick or not, we'll see. But I'm super excited about it. And I think, you know, both of these books have in some ways, I mean, I think secretly, I think this book, Always Crashing in the Same Car, is also a novel of a kind. You know, I am a novelist, and my tools are a novelist's tools, so to speak. But this one, this new one feels very, very alive to me, like incredibly electric. And it does a lot of things that this book, that Always Crashing does not, just in terms of being a, you know, a piece of storytelling and a piece of kind of fully imagined world building. I mean, this one is also involves some world building, but it's a different world that I'm constructing for it.
Well, I'm excited about it, 'cause I think that's a story that needs to be told, you know, because I think especially in Los Angeles, there is some resistance to the reality of the death of the movies as a central cultural concern, at least to the extent that it existed in the 20th century. Like, things have changed.
For sure. And I would add also that, you know, it's not just about the movies per the movie, you know, a lot of the book is going to be New York set. It's, you know, it's really about the end of American cultural hegemony, not just at home, but in the world. You know, because I think the movies were that, you know, they certainly in the latter half of at the very end of the century, once we lost automobiles, and before there was Silicon Valley, they were our primary cultural export. You know, and I think that, you know, it, cultural export at a time when we were very involved in fighting wars abroad and pretending we weren't and all kinds of shit. So it has that involved with it too.
Wow. Well, there, that's a good tease. I'm excited to read that one when you get it done. Hurry up.
Yeah, I'm working, man. I'm working. Taking time off today to have this exciting conversation, which has just been so fun. It's so fun. But yeah, I'm really loving that too.
And then last question, American Dream Machine adaptation.
Ah, I love that question.
Yeah. I mean, just because, I mean, it seems, I don't know, the work that you're doing, like especially that, you know, seems like something that Hollywood would be interested in considering.
That was a fun one, you know, or it was fun and frustrating. You know, before the book sold, I was optioned by Showtime. I wrote a pilot with my friend Michael C. Hall, and it was right when he was wrapping Dexter, and you know, we worked on it together, and we were very good to go. And I think the network was a little, I think they just had other things in mind for Michael. They didn't really know I didn't get the impression anybody there had ever really spent much time reading the novel. And I think that, you know, that pilot, which we were very excited about, they didn't pick it up. So, and you know, the trouble with pilots as opposed to movies, you know, if you write a feature script, usually you can just take it with you to another place, but it's very hard to take a completed pilot to another network. So what wound up happening was I sold the different set of producers took the book to FX, who bought it. And there I think I had a slightly more traditional development process where we just all, my two producers who I really loved, and I wound up kind of torturing ourselves to death in an effort to kind of thread the eye of what we thought the network would make. And by the time we got to the end of it, the network had a competing project in development.
I mean, dude, this all sounds very familiar to me.
Yeah, which it wound up not picking up either. They went to pilot on their other show about a talent agency, but then they didn't pick up that pilot. They didn't go to series. So that book is now out of option, and you know, it's a show for somebody. But right now, I've been too busy writing this book and the next one to really try to lug it anywhere else.
Okay. Well, if there's any consolation, I mean, you know it as well as anyone, especially having written Always Crashing.
Yeah.
The lifetimes of scripts, books, projects in Hollywood, unpredictable is the...
Oh, no, it's wild. I mean, I got a call the other day about the first script I ever wrote, which was an adaptation of Shirley Hazard's novel, The Transit of Venus. And, you know, I've gotten calls about that script on and off for 20 years. You know, and it's like that one seems to be sputtering to life somewhere in the background with the kind of resurgent interest in Shirley. And you know, so it's like, who knows? I have never put too much expectation on anything, any script I've ever written. You know, really, the book... As much as I say in this book, you know, oh, I was a screenwriter, I was this, I've only ever screenwritten when I was lucky enough to be able to do so for money. I've never, you know, sat in a room and thought, I'm going to spec out this movie and it's going to, you know, it's going to get made. Like, I don't do it like that. Yeah. I do it because someone makes me an offer I can't refuse.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, Matthew. Well, I'm a fan and really loved Always Crashing. Just a wonderful read. I didn't want it to end, and I congratulate you on it and wish you all the best on the next one, and hope you'll come back and talk to me about it when the time comes.
Thank you so much, and I hope to see you around our shared neighborhood now that we can all go outside safely. This was really a delight. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you on the microphone or off, so it's really lovely.
All right, that's Matthew Spector. His new book is called Always Crashing in the Same Car, on Art, Crisis, and Los Angeles, California. It is just out from Tin House, and it is excellent. You can find Matthew on the internet at matthewspector.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle over there is @MatthewSpector. One more time, the book is called Always Crashing in the Same Car. Go get your copy right away. Just trust me on this. The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show are made available to you, the listener, free of charge. That's more than 700 episodes and counting. The entire archive available for free. It's a listener-supported show. If you like the program, if you listen and you get something from it and you want to support the show, tip your server. If you have the means to do that, you can do that over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. For as little as $1 per month, you can support this show. There are different tiers, different levels of support. As you go up the scale, you can get stuff. You can get a tote bag, a t-shirt, a sticker, a coffee mug. I'll write you a postcard. I'll wish you a happy birthday. You know the drill. Patreon.com/otherpplpod. Another easy way to support the show and show some love is to rate it and review it over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen. If you rate the show and review the show, it helps other listeners find the show in an algorithmic fashion. If you want to write to me, the email address for the program is letters@otherppl.com.
This show also has its own official app. It, too, is free. The Other People with Brad Listy app is available wherever apps are available. Go get the app. The Other People podcast also has a YouTube presence. Did you know that? That happened this year. The Other People with Brad Listy YouTube channel. Every single episode is up on YouTube. What do you know? So go subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can listen over there if you want. So I am back after being away for a little bit. It's good to be back, I think. Actually, no, it's not.